This is the fifth day of this October 2009 seven-day session. And we'll return to the teachings of Japanese Zen Master Bankei, this from the book titled Bankei Zen, edited by Peter Haskell. We're still under in the large section of the book called Sermons. I've not been using that word because it's just not suitable. I don't think Bankei ever gave a sermon. He gave talks, he gave teishos, maybe discourses, but not sermons. The reason people misunderstand the difference between thoughts and delusions is that everyone imagines thoughts all exist at the bottom and arise from there. But originally, there's no actual substance at the bottom from which thoughts arise. Instead, you retain the things you see and hear, and from time to time, in response to circumstances, the impressions created by these experiences are reflected back to you in precise detail. So when they're reflected, just let them be and refrain from attaching to them. Even if evil thoughts come up, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them, and they can't help but stop. Isn't this just the same as if they didn't arise? That way, there won't be any evil thoughts for you to drive out forcefully, or any remorse about having had them. This is very important, sound advice. I'm going to read a comment on this, read a little bit from it again. He's talking about the difference between thoughts and delusions. Delusions, he seems to be saying, is when we knit together our thoughts and nourish them with our attention. The reason people misunderstand the difference between thoughts and delusions is that everyone imagines thoughts all exist at the bottom and arise from there. But actually there's no substance at the bottom, so-called bottom, from which thoughts arise. You know, the word bottom, sometimes I use that word, say in Doksan, just as Roshi Kaplow did with me, go to the bottom of the questioning. It's just a figure of speech. How can there be a bottom? Let's go completely into, of course. He's describing basic Buddhist psychology, which is that through our experience of the world and our perceptions from our senses. Are not just the five senses, but the sixth thought, that everything we perceive and experience through these six senses is, they're like seeds that are deposited deep in the mind. This is very sobering when we consider the things that we allow into our minds. But these seeds are deposited deep in the mind in what is called the laya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. And then when causes and conditions line up, then these seeds sprout. This is karma. We sow the seeds and then we reap what we've sown. In traditional Buddhism, they talked about the six sense gates, or the sense doors, and our need to, some kinds of Buddhism may say, I need to close up the six sense gates. It doesn't mean, of course, literally, to plug up all your senses, but to keep them closed means not to grasp at sights, or sounds, tastes, smells, feelings, or thoughts. Remember, that's the sixth. Thoughts in and of themselves are just like hearing the train go by, or the crickets, or just having your eyes fall on a mat or the altar or something. It's just fleeting sense impressions that we don't normally call the senses, but we do in Buddhism. Just momentary flickers of sensing thoughts. And it's only when we attach to them that they congeal into something that is more troublesome to us. We know the big ones. The number one, of course, is the sense of self and other, this notion of a separate, permanent entity. And then all the other troublemakers, right and wrong, success and failure, good and bad, superior, inferior, and all the others. So he says, so when they're reflected, that is, when these residual, the stuff that we took in either yesterday or a year ago or 800 lifetimes ago, when these bubble up, when they come to the surface, just let them be, he says, and refrain from attaching to them. Even if evil thoughts come up, just let them come up. Don't involve yourself with them. And they can't help but stop. This is absolutely true. Sometimes people have really dark thoughts or images bubble up during Sesshin. I think it's more common during Sesshin than other times because we're doing this deep excavation of the mind. And some of the really most grotesque and depraved kind of images and thoughts come up. This is also true in dreams. I think it's just standard for people who've been to many sesshins to have experienced this, of dreams that you wouldn't tell your best friend. But there's nothing to be concerned about. It's just old stuff. And the last thing we want to do is to try to draw conclusions from these macabre or depraved things that we see in the mind. There's no conclusions to draw other than, okay, this is some old stuff. It just found its way to the surface. We certainly don't want to waste time during Zazen, especially in Sesshin. We don't want to waste time analyzing it. Because any of this, the analyzing, the conclusion drawing, is all just revolves around the self, our notion of ourself. Oh my God, how could I have thoughts or images like that? What kind of a psychopath am I? What's going on here? And if it helps, just consider that this material that comes up may not even be from this lifetime. It can't be held responsible for what happened in a previous lifetime. That way, he says, there won't be any evil thoughts for you to drive out forcefully or any remorse about having had them. That's what the mind of ego wants us to do, is get involved with these things. It's like the ego is saying, oh, no, no, don't look at Mu, don't look at your breath. Over here. Over here. Wow, look at this. Isn't that horrible? Come on. Look, look. Don't look. He goes on, because the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, mental impressions from the past are reflected, and you make the mistake of labeling as delusions things that aren't delusions at all. Delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. What foolishness it is to create the anguish of delusion by changing the precious Buddha mind, pondering over this and that, mulling over things of no worth. If there were anyone who actually succeeded at something by pondering it all the way through, it might be all right to do things that way. But I've never heard of anyone who, in the end, was able to accomplish anything like this. So, pondering over things is useless, isn't it? It's utterly useless. I always give this advice to people who come into sesshin with some very troubling personal problem, maybe in their marriage or maybe their health, some decision they have to make about their health or their job or their family. And try to convince the person that it really is not of much value to sit and dwell on these things in sesshin. That's our tendency, of course. We all know that. If we have something, some crisis or serious decision we have to make, our tendency is to chew on these things and sift through thoughts about the problem over and over, on and on and on and on and on. When has that ever gotten us anywhere? I agree completely with Bankei. We just spend time in our heads. What is far more value is to dive under the waves of these thoughts. Get underneath them. And of course, the way to do that is leave them alone. How do you do that? We know, don't we? Through single-minded absorption in the practice. And then what we find is that once we get under them, they sort of they recede. They get more distant, these problems. And then we can actually get a new perspective on them. It's a much more effective way of coming to terms with these thorny issues in our life is not to deal with them at all. This is what makes Zen so radically different from ordinary problem-solving approaches. Is we solve the problem, or we at least come to terms with it somehow, by not trying to solve it, but just withdrawing the energy from it, withdrawing our attention from it, and then reaching deeper into this reservoir of wisdom that we all have within us, and that gives us a new understanding of the thing. Not by thinking about it, but it just pops up. Suddenly we see the whole matter in a fresh way, a different way. It's really so liberating if we can have faith in this no mind, not all the stuff and all the machinations of our ordinary mind, our problem-solving mind, but just to put all of our faith in this no mind of Mu, or the breath. Who am I? What is it? Let me reread this sentence. This is one of my favorite sentences in this book, where he says, delusions means the anguish of thought feeding on thought. And then he tells a long story. I won't read the whole thing, but a chunk of it that begins as follows. Last year, when I was giving talks at my temple, the people from 3 or 4 Ri came around to listen. Ri is a unit of distance. Well, let's find out what it is. I've looked this up 10 times. Can't remember what a Ri or a Li is. Six to 8 miles. All right, so say 50 miles. People from 50 miles around came to listen. You know, and they didn't drive there. And we had as big a crowd as the one that comes to such and such and such and such. At this time, there were 2 merchants from Hirado, an uncle and nephew, who were embroiled in a lawsuit. The uncle had filed a formal petition of complaint with the magistrate and was pressing it determinedly, but whatever the nature of the suit, it proved a difficult one, and even the magistrate was hard put to resolve it and had become fed up with the whole affair. For 3 years, the case dragged on, bitterly, bitterly deadlocked. Meanwhile, having failed to reach any settlement, the uncle and nephew stopped exchanging visits and broke off all relations. Then one day, the uncle came to hear my talk and gradually became convinced by what he heard. He came to me and said, truly, up till now I'd never dreamed I was exchanging the Buddha mind I have from my parents innately for a fighting demon, a hell dweller, a beast, or a hungry ghost. These are 4 of the 6 realms of unenlightened existence. I'm sure there's no greater unfiliality toward one's parents. What's more, a nephew is an intimate member of the family, just like one's own son. It's not as if he were a stranger. Yet the truth is that because of the baseness of my own desires, I've been indulging in self-centeredness, which isn't at all innate, attached to worldly concerns. How could I ever let things come to this? Uncle and nephew turned into mortal enemies, about to condemn themselves to transmigrate forever, dying and being reborn amid the 3 evil realms. That's the 3 lowest of the 6 realms. Hell, hungry ghosts, and animals. Reflecting like this, without even returning home, he went straight from where I was giving the talk to see the magistrate and told him, I have put your honor to much trouble in this lawsuit with my nephew and am sincerely grateful for all you've done. However, today for the first time, I heard the Venerable Bankei's talk and I've realized my mistake. Misled by my own petty desires, with no shame about what people might say, I brought charges against my own nephew before your honor, pressing them relentlessly, filled only with hatred and lacking any sympathy at all. Now that I've realized my error, I feel completely ashamed. I therefore humbly request your honor to return to me the petition I gave you. Well, the magistrate readily agreed, and he praised the uncle for this change of heart, and he gave him the petition. And the uncle returned home and then placed the petition inside his robe and went to see the nephew, whom he hadn't visited for 3 years. He took the nephew completely by surprise. Strange, he thought to himself. This is the nephew, dumbfounded. This uncle files a lawsuit against me for 3 years, severs all contact between us, doesn't pay a single visit, and now he comes to see me this way. Why? Certainly it's hard to figure. What's going on? It just doesn't feel right. Still, there was his uncle, and even while they might not have been on speaking terms, now that he had arrived and announced himself, there was no way the nephew could escape. So he told him, "Welcome. Please come in." In this country, the nephew would have a gun, of course, and and take him out, you know. "Welcome. Please come in." And while the nephew was thinking, "I wonder what he's got to say," his uncle declared, "I realize my coming here must seem strange, but I had to tell you this. You and I are uncle and nephew, but, old as I am, I've acted like a child, setting myself against you who are young, wrongfully starting a lawsuit and breaking off all relations between us for 3 years. But today, after hearing the Venerable Bankei's wonderful teaching, I'm completely ashamed of myself. I've behaved disgracefully in front of everyone, and now, filled with remorse, I've come here to offer my apologies. So please forgive me for the wrong I've done. And to prove to you that I'm not going to prosecute this lawsuit any further, today, as soon as I left the place where the Venerable Bankei was delivering his talk, I went straight to the magistrate, took back the petition I'd given him, and brought it here to show to you and set your mind at ease. Here, see for yourself," the uncle said, drawing the lawsuit from his robe. Now the nephew, thinking, "Well, I'd never expected him to behave like such a model uncle," the nephew said. "What could be more wonderful? I was at fault for failing to accord you the respect due as my senior. I've truly violated heaven's will and feel completely ashamed. I have no parents now, so whatever it was my duty to ask your advice and accept your orders and instructions. Instead, my behavior has been unmentionable. Whatever you told me, it was my duty to obey you without any protest, but I opposed you and drove you to file a lawsuit with the magistrate. To have acted like this was unmindful of the way of heaven, heedless of the gods and Buddhas. There is nowhere I can hide my shame before my own dead father. Please forgive me," and so forth. And then, when the nephew had spoken, the uncle said, "No, no, not at all. The fault is mine, and it's I who ask for forgiveness." And they go on and on. And the uncle they patched up the whole thing. The uncle lingered leisurely at the nephew's house and was lavishly feasted before returning home. And then the nephew put on his formal attire and returned the courtesy by going to visit his uncle. And then it says, Bankei says, all who witnessed this were deeply moved. Those in the neighboring towns who were conducting lawsuits of their own, on hearing about this, yielded to reason, gave way in their selfish insistence, and went each and every one to withdraw the lawsuits they presented. Some 17 petitions had been submitted to the magistrates, but nevertheless, I understand that all 17 were withdrawn. It's not so far-fetched to think that this really happened. We always have to consider from in these accounts that happened so long ago that are a little hard to imagine how much of it is true, but this is not beyond credibility that this happened. And assuming it did, it just shows what a remarkable effect one person can have who steps out of this tired, old way of conflict, and even you know, let's assume that the uncle had his share in this dispute, his share of responsibility in this dispute, but the courage it took, and the faith to just go forward and apologize, and then we see what a remarkable effect it had, like just ripples going out from one person of understanding. Life is too short to stay embroiled in personal disputes with people. This is the kind of thing that the people who have regrets on their deathbed regret, taking up so much energy in these petty disagreements. Lao Tzu famously said, "Behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. Behind the disputable, there is always something indisputable." That something, of course, is Mu. Beyond contention, beyond opposition. Another time, Bankei said, "If you divided the day into three parts, you'd find that of all your activities from morning till night, two-thirds would be managed with the unborn. Yet, without realizing this, you imagine you operate entirely through cleverness and discrimination, a serious error indeed." So, of course, he's referring to the kind of simple activities that we do that don't require the involvement of this discriminating mind. One might quarrel with the percentages that he gives. Some people would have work, they're working 8 hours a day at very fine intellectual work. But the point for us is that there's an awful lot of time when we don't need to be thinking, when we can open ourselves to this Buddha mind and let it function as it does so beautifully and fluidly if we get out of the way. Getting out of the way means, of course, stopping thinking unnecessarily about things. We all get a sense of this as Sesshin goes on, how fluidly we move and how well we can function when we are more absorbed in this no mind that takes the form of whatever our practice is. It's one of the many benefits of going to many Sesshins, is little by little discovering how effective we are without thought in the mind. And not to mention how energetic we become when our energy is not being sapped through unnecessary thoughts. It's so confirming. Roshi Kaplow always used to say that in Zen, faith means experience. faith comes from experience. When we experience the luminous quality of our mind, the flowing, energetic quality of the mind in Sesshin, we confirm that this is its nature when it is unencumbered by thoughts. The more times we return to this kind of smooth, clear functioning in Sesshin, the more convinced we become of this mind with a capital M. And that's what really nurtures our faith. It's not a matter of just believing something. It's finding out directly through our own experience that this is true. And when I talk about thought, I don't mean just some preoccupation that you're sorting through in your mind, but a more subtle, almost indiscernible background noise to the mind that we don't even know is going on there in our ordinary lives, that we see how differently we function when that gets quieter and quieter, when we turn down the dial on that background noise. Just to repeat that last sentence, without realizing this, you imagine you operate entirely through cleverness and discrimination, a serious error indeed. As for the remaining third, unable to abide in the unborn, you change your Buddha mind for thoughts, attaching to things that come your way, so that even right in this life you're creating fighting demons, creating beasts, creating hungry ghosts. Just to be clear, even when we are using the thinking mind, if we're not separating ourselves from that process, from the analyzing, the reading, the computing, the adding, whatever mental operations we're performing, if we're one with it, that is the functioning of this unborn mind. Right there. The problem comes, as always, when we separate ourselves, when we're analyzing some data and with part of our mind, and the other part we're thinking how much we'd rather be doing something else. That's that split. It's the split that causes all of this unnecessary suffering, this bondage to the mind. It's the split. When we're thoroughly absorbed in even the most sophisticated, most demanding kind of intellectual work, we can actually reach a samadhi. Because that's really what samadhi means. It means no separation. You're completely fused with the process. You're one with it. And when we are that way, when we are so thoroughly absorbed in the mental process that we have to do, then the evidence of it being whole and not split is the energy we feel afterward. Can be doing work like that, whether it's a crossword puzzle or something else, can be very energizing. We finish with it and we notice the energy. That's joriki. Joriki, the energy that accrues, that builds from a concentrated mind, from a mind that is not divided. as another example of the unborn function of the Buddha mind. When you're just there with no particular thought at all, and someone puts a flame to your fingertips, you give a start, and without thinking, automatically pull back your hand. This too is proof that the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind is unborn and perfectly manages everything. On the other hand, to think, that was a flame just now, and then realize, it's hot, and get angry with a fellow who burned you, is to fall into the realm of secondary experience, deliberating after the fact. I tell my students and those of you coming regularly here to the temple, be stupid, because you've got the dynamic function of the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind. Even if you get rid of discriminative understanding, you won't be foolish. So here he's really, when he says be stupid, he really means be simple. And when he says foolish, he means, well, stupid, misguided. So all of you, from here on, be stupid. Even if you're stupid, when you're hungry, you'll ask for something to eat. When you're thirsty, you'll ask for some tea. When it gets warm, you'll put on thin, light clothes. And when it's cold, you'll put on more clothes. As far as your activities of today are concerned, you're not lacking a thing. With people who are clever, there are sure to be a great many shortcomings. To have transcended those clever people whom all the world holds in great esteem is what's meant by stupidity. There's really nothing wrong with being a blockhead. Especially in Sesshin. If ever there's a chance to be a blockhead, it's in Sesshin. And we discover all kinds of resources we weren't aware of when we turn down the noise of this discriminating mind. He goes on, when people say that someone is a clever fellow, I ask to meet him. And when I do and we have a chance to talk, it looks to me as if people in the world are praising an awful lot of foolishness. The fact is that those clever people acclaimed by the world are, from the start, deluded by their own cleverness. They distort the Buddha mind and obscure its marvelously illuminating dynamic function, considering other people as of no account, contradicting whatever they say, slighting and insulting them. The true person's ideal is to show kindness to those who are foolish and help those who are evil. To be recognized as a good person by the people of the world is precisely what makes being born a human being worthwhile. How can it be any good to earn yourself the reputation of a wicked person? Well, I'm guessing that everyone who makes it to Sesshin certainly understands this. Probably anyone who comes to practice appreciates the fact that some of the smartest people in the world are not only some of the most miserable people, but also make other people miserable very often. Smart people, clever people are often crafty and wily and think only of themselves and find devious ways of getting ahead of others and taking advantage of others, exploiting others. This is not news to anyone. What really counts in the end? How will we regard ourselves as we're facing death? He goes on, so when you go back to your homes and meet your old acquaintances, you should have them wondering about you all. How did Bankei teach them Buddhism anyway? Why, they've come back even more stupid than before they left. What I'm talking about isn't the stupidity of stupidity and understanding. That which transcends stupidity and understanding is what I mean by stupidity. Okay, simplicity. Roshi Kapo talks about how at Hoshinji, the monastery where he spent the first 3 years of his practice in Japan, they would sometimes in the Zendo during Sesshin say, you must become a mu simpleton or a mu idiot. This is good advice. Certainly in Sesshin, when we don't have any responsibilities to speak of, to detach from the workings of the mind and just sink deep into this pure stillness of the mu or the breath, whatever one's koan is, one will notice already, you've all noticed, us becoming more simple. Everything gets more simple as the mind simplifies through this persistent absorption in the practice. There's no greater reward, I feel, in life than to experience this kind of simplicity. Everything becomes so much easier and richer. And we get a taste of this in Sesshin. We realize that how important it is to simplify our lives, and the best way of doing that is to simplify the mind. It all unfolds from there. It all happens. It's maybe a better word than I even realized, unfold. We get so caught up in the folds of this brain of ours, and to have that unfold into the seamless purity of a still mind is to really experience life fully for the first time. And although outside Sesshin we can't do this much sitting, still, the more we do, the more we will find things simplifying. One left. To exert yourselves in religious practice, trying to produce enlightenment by doing religious practices and zazen, is all wrong. There's no difference between the mind of all the Buddhas and the Buddha mind of each one of you. But by wanting to realize enlightenment, you create a duality between the one who realizes enlightenment and what it is that's being realized. When you cherish even the smallest desire to realize enlightenment, right away you leave behind the realm of the unborn and go against the Buddha mind. This Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is one alone, not two, not three. What this means is not to cling to the idea of Kensho, of getting through your koan. This is the most lethal thing in the mind. And if one has a real aspiration for liberation, to awaken from this nightmare of division, if one has that kind of aspiration, it's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult to let go of that thought of freedom, of enlightenment. But it has to be let go of, because that a single trace of that thought sets up a duality, as Bankei says. That's the division. Enlightenment, no enlightenment. even slight distinctions made, set earth and heaven far apart. Even slight, the slightest distinctions, set earth and heaven far apart. Luckily, we don't have to just try in vain to not think about enlightenment. What we have is this practice. And by pouring our mind 100% into the practice, we can find our way beyond that thought. The practice, the mu or whatever, it becomes so consuming. It becomes so full and absorbing that it absorbs toxins like the thought of enlightenment. But it has to be 100%. We can't just do it 3/4 or 9/10. We have to go all the way into this practice that we're working on, and in that way get beyond even the most exalted thoughts. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.